Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Thanks for tuning in, or pressing play, as it will, on a new episode of Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. I am Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, and he is an information securities analyst for the finance and travel industries, and will be running for state legislature in 2020. And this is Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify. Make sure you like us on all your favorite social media platforms at Plastic Cup Pod. This is a drinking and politics podcast focusing on Arizona. And guess what? We're going to talk to Dr. Sean Hayes right now and ask him, hey, man, what are you drinking?
Back to a classic. Just some Jamesons.
All right.
Yeah. And when it's single malt scotch, I am I take it neat. But when we're talking about a more run-of-the-mill whiskey, I enjoy it over ice.
I like to pretend that I like drinking whiskey, but really it's just trying to get it in. So I'm more of a shot guy. Yeah. And I don't do that as well. And I don't do those all that well either. had a fantasy football draft today, and luckily I did not have to do any of the Prairie Fire shots that were the box shots. And guys, if you really love fantasy football and you really love draft day, be in an auction league, because then you get to do it for like two or three times as long. I was in a draft today for 6 hours.
Jesus.
Yeah. So anyway, but I made it back here so I could talk to Sean, and I am drinking from my neck of the woods, the Achocalypse from Prescott Brewing Company. Little chocolate porter. Delicious. We can just go ahead and jump on into it, because I'm going to need Sean to talk me down a little bit. We have been talking about local elections and how much your vote counts. We got our primary results from the primary here in Arizona. It's, for me, looking at it the way that I do, doesn't look all that great. So any of you that know the kind of how this podcast started, it was my extreme dislike of Paul Gosar, and I wanted to do something to get Paul Gosar out of office. We had some good candidates. Paul Gosar got 84,000 votes. And the Democratic, what's the word I'm looking for?
Candidate.
There you go. Those candidates, if you include the 303 votes that the Green Party got, came in at about 23,000.
Sure.
I mean, we knew it was going to be a hard race. This doesn't seem like it's going to be hard. This seems next to impossible.
As much as we would like to stay sort of upbeat about our chances in November, fact is that there are still some races out there in the country that are going to be unwinnable for a Democrat, and your district is one of them. We would need a sort of a sustained blue wave over several election cycles, really, to sort of wear down the influence of the right wing in the extremely large district that you live in.
Well, I mean, that is actually true, because I was in Globe and still seeing signs for Gosar.
Yep.
Like, wow. This is also a district that has only been around for, I don't know when it came in. I think it might have came in 2010 or something like that. But anyway, supremely gerrymandered, mm-hmm. However you told me how to say it.
It's Jerry.
I mean, like, are we talking less than a snowball's chance in hell?
We have considerably more than a snowball's chance in hell. Well, in terms of flipping your district in November, maybe a tiny bit more than a snowball's chance in hell, but not much, right? Because really what has to happen with districts like the one you live in, because of the extreme gerrymandering in those districts, they're literally designed to be perpetually safe seats for the Republican Party. We're going to have to capture a majority throughout the rest of the state in time for redistricting in 2020, right? Because the redistricting takes place after the next census, and the next census is in 2020. If we can do that, then we can reapportion the districts in ways that aren't so obviously designed to provide a perpetual political advantage to one party.
Would it be a giant help to this effort if, say, we had more Democrats in the House, the state House and Senate, and in the governor's seat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. That's the only way it gets done, actually. Because every other attempt that we've made to institute sane and nonpartisan redistricting rules here in Arizona, the GOP has defeated at every turn. To be honest, they've given up at this point on trying to find other rationalizations for their actions. They used to try and pretend that there were other reasons for doing what they were doing, and now they just come right out and say it. You know, they're redistricting in order to give themselves a perpetual advantage.
This might be an interesting spin on bad news, but our not friend, David Stringer, Mr. There Aren't Enough White Kids to Go Around in Schools. He, of course, won his primary. But here's the thing. You get to vote for two, and his running mates got 43% of the vote, and he only got 37% of the vote. So I do think that maybe 6% of Republicans in my district do have some kind of a conscience.
Wow. Well, that's hopeful. Either they have a conscience, or you're talking about business owners who are, like, you know, terrified of what comes next for the tourism industry in in that district, if they keep sending crazy fucking people to Congress and to the state house.
Speaking of crazy people in primaries, let's just jump right into Florida.
Oh boy, Florida's the best. Not to live in, but to watch.
By the way, here's a little quick aside. You want to know why all the weird stories you hear are out of Florida? You may actually know this. All the weird stories you hear out of Florida is because all the police records have to be given to the newspapers. So they get all the stories. So all the stories that don't make our papers, they all have to go. So that's why you hear all the weird stuff out of Florida.
Although I think that there's probably
a lot of weird ass people in Florida.
Yeah, you've got a really interesting mixture of, you know, you've got up in the panhandle, you've got like legit bog-dwelling hillbillies. You know, down in the southern tip, you've got most of Cuba, you know, and then you've got like the Orlando white bread zone in sort of the knee of the state. So you've got all of these really interesting elements. And then, of course, everywhere that there aren't people living, there are currently anacondas trying to murder crocodiles. So it's a really interesting state.
In this really interesting state, they had their primary, and the, not status quo, but the preferred Republican candidate and the preferred Democratic candidate both kind of went the way of the dodo, and instead we have Mini Trump versus Black Bernie.
Yeah, that just about sums it up. Florida is this weird linchpin state. It's been this, you know, this sort of intense political battleground for probably the last 10 presidential election cycles. If there was a state in the union where we were going to see this sort of extreme polarization played out, Florida would be the one I would pick. So in Florida, you ended up with it's a demonstration of what I've been saying about primaries and why we don't need primaries, why we need to go back to a convention. The gentleman mayor who's now the Democratic candidate for governor, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name.
Andrew Gilliam
may be a phenomenal person, but he is not necessarily the best answer for recapturing, I guess, some degree of sanity in the United States right now. What we need is sort of a gradual transition back towards the center, swinging even further left than we did last time. Isn't going to win any converts from the sort of the mass of deplorables that, as much as I want to write them off, we have to live with those people. They're not all going to drop dead overnight or move to Somalia or wherever, you know, someplace where they have no laws and can live out their libertarian fantasies. so we have to have some plan for carrying on. And so the Democratic Party can't all of a sudden embrace the hard left of its own base as a strategy for winning in the upcoming election. It will drive moderates away from the party. Gilliam, you know, again, he may be a great dude, maybe a great leader. This is the wrong person for them to have chosen.
I would also like to say that I think Ron DeSantis is the wrong person
coming
from the other
doubt.
Side.
Without a doubt.
I'm sure that if you haven't seen his stupid ad by now or heard it, just go look it up about him teaching his kids how to build a wall and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, this is super placating and terrible. But let's just go ahead and move on past that, and let's move on to him talking about Andrew Gillum. And how he's well-spoken.
Yeah.
Everybody loves it when you, Colin Powell is very well-spoken.
Just fucking did this 10 years ago. We had this exact same goddamn discussion during Barack Obama's first run. Somebody referred to him as very well-spoken, very articulate. Mm-hmm. We had this exact same fucking discussion. No one in this country ever goddamn learns. Yes, it's a horrifying insult to refer to him as articulate or well-spoken, because the implication there is that black people normally are not well-spoken or articulate, and so he is exceptional for being so.
An outlier.
Yeah, he's an outlier for being well-spoken, which is not only factually incorrect, but just like grotesquely racist.
Would that be more or less than when he said that the state shouldn't monkey around or didn't need to monkey around?
Monkey it up. Let's not monkey this up is what he said.
Oh, sorry. Oh, you're right, because monkey around is actually something that people say.
Yes. Yeah, no one actually says let's not monkey this up. People who have listened regularly know that I don't really buy into many conspiracy theories, but this one is not this one doesn't require any conspiracy or theorizing. There is a well-documented record since the mid-70s of the Republican Party using what are called dog whistles as a way of communicating with the more openly racist members of their base and motivating them to turn out for elections. So referring to the very first black candidate for mayor in the state of Florida and using the word monkey as a descriptor, even tangentially, that is it is absolutely a calculated dog whistle. They did it on purpose.
I will say that you're actually the first person to introduce me to a dog whistle, not on this show, but many, many years ago when we were at a gun store and somebody we were talking about the Springfield XD that it was a Czech design. But anyway, the salesman was talking about how the old ones were, you know, $300 cheaper, but now it's made by Springfield, so now all the monkeys want to go out and buy them.
Yeah.
And you were very upset about that, and I totally didn't get it, because I'm like, well, yeah, he's saying that idiots, like, because maybe it's just because I still want an XD. But you were like, no, that was not cool, and I totally didn't get it. But I think, have we moved on past, because I still don't know if that guy was... I still disagree with you on that. Have we gotten to the point now that you don't get
there's not as much leeway. You don't get as many do-overs as you have in the past.
But you don't get the benefit of a doubt.
Yeah. You know what? At this point, I kind of think we have. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. We've been giving people the benefit of the doubt for a very long fucking time now, and it hasn't worked out well. We've been giving people in the South the benefit of the doubt since fucking Reconstruction. We gave them the benefit of the doubt all through Jim Crow. We gave them the benefit of the doubt all through the 60s and 70s and the battles of the Civil Rights era. At what point do we just stop going, you know what? I'm sure their intentions are good. You know, they don't mean to be racist. At what point do we stop doing that and go, no, you know, all right, we're more than 100 years in at this point. Yeah, you're fucking racist. Fuck you.
Or at least we can do things like we're doing now and saying, no, you can't do that. And so maybe when Roseanne Barr got fired for making a Planet of the Apes reference, he might have realized that referring to black people as monkeys, not as monkeys, but just you just kind of want to avoid it altogether. Is this a good idea to just avoid monkeys altogether?
Yeah.
And okay, how many people have to say that before we go, there's no reason you say that. Like, guess what? That's a new racial slur. But don't worry, it gets much worse, because apparently there's been a robocall going around Florida with, I have not heard it, so I will not try to interpret what I'm assuming it sounds like, but we'll just lay it out for you. Drums and monkeys playing in the background, and then somebody coming on stating, I is Andrew Gilliam, and then kind of going on about how that if Negroes are accused of crimes and they say they didn't do it, then we should let them out, et cetera, and so forth. Anyway, pretty much just the most racist thing you've ever heard in your life.
So I had to explain to someone recently, and I don't point this out to say that that person was a bad person or anything like that, but I pointed out to say that we are, as a way of pointing to the fact that we are failing to educate people in this country about racism because we want to hide our heads in the sand and pretend that it doesn't exist anymore. I had to explain to someone recently what a minstrel show was. And I saw that robocall referred to using those words today, right? They said that it was the person spoke in a voice reminiscent of a minstrel show.
Yes.
And so the first thing that I think to myself is how many people who are in the gray zone with regard to race, right, saw that headline, had no idea what a fucking minstrel show was, and moved on.
Probably thought it had something to do with a lady business and got scared.
Yeah, it's a new vagina monologues. So anyone who's curious about what they're referring to, you can Google Step and Fetch It. Is one of the more famous ones that actually made it through to – it carried on long enough to be filmed. And Amos and Andy is actually sort of a category of minstrel show. And you can certainly get a feeling for what they're referring to when they refer to something as being like a minstrel show.
Yeah, just basically black stereotypes turned up to like 14 or 20 or
and these are, in particular, these are some black stereotypes that we actually don't see all that often in contemporary in modern United States, right? Because racism has sort of gone underground, we've sublimated it, it's much more subtle now, which a lot of people argue, and I think they have a point, actually makes it even worse. A lot of the minstrel show characters, the black characters, were – have you ever been to an antique shop and you've seen the little salt and pepper shakers of the black lady with like the – she's got the huge sort of like pink orange lips and like – yeah.
The Sambos.
Yeah. Well, it would be people dressed up like that, right? And they would speak like Jar Jar Binks.
Yep.
So there's a reference that a lot of our younger listeners should be able to get. I wish they didn't, but
say things like, I is Andrew Gilliam.
Yeah. Misa gonna make the state better.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's a really, it's the kind of racism that you expect to see at Klan rallies. Not via robocalls in a gubernatorial election in one of the most politically influential states in the union.
So here's my question. I mean, I'm sure that Ron DeSantis is not any way associated with this robocall. I really wouldn't think that he's probably associated with it at all. But if he was, he's not any way associated to where he could be connected with it.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're saying that you're going to be running for election, what happens if somebody attacks one of your opponents in a truly horrific way that you have nothing to do with?
Yeah.
Like, what happens when somebody runs something for your benefit that you do not agree with at all? Like, how do you get out of that? Like,
you have to own it, and you have to be sincere in your ownership of it, right? It's still okay to say, hey, look, I didn't have anything to do with planning this out. I don't agree with this message, but someone did this on my behalf, and so I need to address it. Right? This isn't okay. This isn't representative of who I will be as, you know, as a represent, a member of government. A simple, single, sincere statement of repudiation, and then you can move on. And people will eat that up. That's what they are dying for.
But it's not like the people on our side aren't still going to blame him for it.
Of course they're still going to blame him for it.
You know, down in their hearts. It just seems like it sucks that if you have nothing to do with something like that blatantly horrible and racist, like it's going to be attached to your name forever.
Keep in mind that conservatives like Ron DeSantis, if not him directly, created the legal environment where it's possible to run these kind of ads and have the water be so muddy. It's literally impossible to say whether or not he was associated with the group that actually ran the ad. There's no evidence one way or the other. And people like him are responsible for that. You reap what you fucking sow.
Voting is very important.
Mm-hmm.
We've already discussed that. So do you think that Florida is going to be the 2020 of 2018? Do you think that it is the far right versus the far left? Do you think that Florida, since Florida did go Obama twice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably, especially for 2020, sort of as a bellwether for 2020. This upcoming election, could provide some interesting indicators of the way 2020 might go. What it did do was demonstrate pretty firmly that people have started to reattach blame to the parties themselves. In some of these more extreme, politically extreme states like Florida, what you're seeing is if you are the officially endorsed candidate of one of the two major parties, you're actually at a disadvantage at this point. These insurgent candidates have been having a fantastic 18 months, and I don't see any reason that that's going to change anytime soon, especially because the Democratic Party, for some bizarre fucking reason, just absolutely refuses to cut away dead weight like Pelosi. I don't get it. The entire country is telling you that this woman is a drag on your prospects to recapture the House and the Senate. And that is the only way that you're going to be able to stop a dictator from ascending to power. And still, this woman is being looked to as the next speaker. It's ridiculous.
She fundraises like crazy, though. So.
Yeah, no, she brings in a shitload of money. Absolutely.
So what we are really aiming for here is that blue wave. And you know who really hates the blue wave? The red. So evidently it's come out that the Republicans have already kind of came up with a list of what the Democrats, if they control the House, are probably going to investigate. And it's a really, really long list.
Here's the interesting part. If you go and take a look at that list, God damn it, the vast majority of them are legit investigations. Like, I wish there was enough of a story here for me to go, yeah, well, you know, the GOP's kind of got a point. There are some of these things that are kind of spurious. You know, it's going to be a waste of the people's time. No, the argument that they seem to be making here is, yes, we did all of this bad shit. But if you elect our opponents and we get punished for having done that bad shit, the country's going to fall apart.
What?
You kind of answered my question, which is how many of these things should be investigated? Because when you do look at it, they're not necessarily small things.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're talking about stuff that rises potentially to the level of treason in some cases. I think that the Democrats have been smart in sort of not embracing that kind of talk. I think that they probably could be a little more vigorous in embracing impeachment. They have calculated, and I can't necessarily argue convincingly against them on this point. I have a gut instinct that says that they should embrace impeachment a little more firmly, but they're looking at the actual numbers, and the numbers are indicating that people are kind of freaked out about the prospect of impeachment. And so what they would prefer ultimately is, even if the Democrats intend to vote for impeachment, that they just not focus on that right now. And so that's what the DNC is doing. And it's really frustrating to some of the people on the hard left.
I don't know about embracing it. I don't think they should dodge the question, but I don't think that it should be, you know, a platform for impeachment. But I mean, if you're asked if you think that the president should be impeached, it seems like it would be easy to say there are certain laws in place and certain procedures. And if something, you know, if a president is found to have committed crimes, then it's the House's job to impose articles of impeachment or something to that effect, only sounding way better and like they know what they're saying. And not saying, no, I want to get in there and impeach him. Just say, you're going to put me into the House to do my job, and I'm going to do my job for the American people. I'm not going to hide.
If the evidence
crimes
supports impeachment, then I'll impeach. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, I agree. But unfortunately, that kind of nuanced message really gets fucked up in our modern news ecosystem. Right. And it's not just the 24-hour news cycle. The 24-hour news cycle is actually even a little bit better for nuanced positions like that one, because they can just fucking hammer at it incessantly for 48 hours at a time. Right. When you're talking about sort of like tweet-sized journalism and fucking, you know, news aggregators, so where people are only reading the five-sentence synopsis and the headline, you know, these things, that kind of argument doesn't lend itself well to that kind of journalism. And the people who are conducting that kind of journalism aren't necessarily journalists. And so even if you get a candidate who offers a nuanced perspective like that, it will be reported as supports impeachment.
I don't think it should be that nuanced, because you just go, yeah, I support impeachment as a tool for everyone. Or not everyone.
Hell, there are days where I support it for everyone, to be honest. I'm not even talking about government. Like, you can get there are some kids that I think should be impeached from daycare. I think, you know, just impeachment in general, like, you just no longer get to do this thing because you suck at it. Wow. That should become like a meme online. But I'm not creative or dedicated enough to make it happen.
All right. Sean wants to be able to kick everybody out of life. Awesome.
Sorry. The one thing that I did want to say, the very best answer they could probably give at this point is like, look, I have not seen the evidence. Once the special prosecutor's report is presented, if the evidence contained in the report supports articles of impeachment, I will vote to impeach. And if it doesn't, I won't.
Nailed it. Hey, Sean, you're kind of in like the nerd industry.
Yeah.
Is Google trying to squash the right?
No. The right makes Google a fuckload of money. They don't want to squash the right. Look, and besides, the one thing that you could do as Google to depreciate your brand, right, to just drive your brand value into the fucking ground, is to ever, ever have there be credible, and I stress credible, allegations that you are fixing search results, right? So Google, even though it's extremely secretive about its algorithm, right, is actually extremely open about decisions it makes around its algorithm, right? It announces those regularly to the community because it doesn't want the community to ever get the impression that, oh, Google secretly changed the rules and it affected my search ranking. Oh, they're trying to fuck me over, right? Because that's the only thing that Google can do to fuck over their brand at this point. They're almost bulletproof. So this is the one hot button issue, which may very well be why Shitstain picked up on it. Someone in his coterie of villains tipped him off to the fact that their Achilles heel is this perception of impartiality for the algorithm.
No, I believe it was Tucker Carlson.
No, I have to give credit to that guy.
I'm pretty sure it was Tucker Carlson. Either way, he was watching a Fox News show, and they were able to backtrack from his tweet and see what was on Fox News and trace it back to Tucker Carlson the night before.
Jesus Christ.
So McGahn is going to be leaving office here in the fall.
Yep, found out about it via tweet.
Yes. How cowardly is our president? You heard him talk to Omarosa about how he had no idea she was being fired and how he can't do any. That's so terrible. And who was it chief of staff that got found out that he was fired via tweet while he was sitting on the can?
No, that was the Secretary of State.
And then now McGahn found out via tweet that he is retiring.
Yeah, leaving office at some unspecified point in the fall after they've gotten Kavanaugh confirmed.
And I do know that you have stated on a previous podcast that McGahn is far from your favorite person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he did just happen to talk to Mueller for 30 hours. Do you think that had anything to do with this removal from post?
Oh, yeah, guaranteed. Look, for people who just aren't familiar with the history or have forgotten it, the way that Watergate ultimately broke, right, what completely shattered the dam was that the White House counsel went and talked to the special prosecutor went to talk to prosecutors at the DOJ and gave them the goods on the president. Symbolism that heavy can get through even to the orange one. Right. And so, yeah, the second they realized that he had been testifying sort of, out of the pocket,
John Deaning him, if you will.
Yeah. John Deaning him. There's also, going off the reservation as its way is how it's often referred to. As soon as he found that out, everyone knew McGahn's days were numbered at that point. But McGahn, he can't just shit can him immediately, because McGahn is the guy who's been running the confirmation push for Brett Kavanaugh.
By the way, don't worry. I've not forgotten about the hot take from last week, because we definitely had some people online noticing the hot take on Kavanaugh. So we're still going to get there.
Yeah.
But before we do that, I would just like to talk about how great this economy is doing and how it's never going to stop. But somehow we had to put a hold on wage increases for federal employees. And by the way, these are not raises for federal employees. We are talking about inflation wage increases.
Yep. Cost of living adjustments.
There you go.
So, yeah, Donald Trump is a petty, vindictive piece of shit. And it has thus far been career civil servants who have blocked him. To the extent that that we've been able to check his efforts to tear the country down. And so he lashed out at them by once again deferring cost of living adjustments for them. They have not had a cost of living adjustment since before the Great Recession. So most of them are already being paid less than the cost of living in their area. It's one of the things that drives me the most batty about the conservative movement, in the United States. Most of the people who talk all of this shit about federal employees depend heavily on services that only run smoothly by virtue of the hard work of federal employees. These people break their backs, right, for much less than they could typically make in the private sector, because they have a dedication to their country, which, is something that most members of the modern GOP just absolutely can't understand.
When you say federal employee, what are some of the basic federal employee jobs? Are we talking about, like, the Postal Service?
Postal workers would be among them. And keep in mind that, as the orange one pointed out a couple of months ago, even though he's sort of, this is a touchy subject for me, the fight between, Trump and
Bezos. We can come to that another time. Personally, I hope they both fall into a black hole. For those of you who really love your Amazon Prime, most of it gets to your doorstep by virtue of the United States Postal Service. So for all the shit we talk about postal workers, most of us are goddamn hypocrites.
But no, I was more asking like just normal people that you might run into. Or is it all mainly behind the scenes?
Most of our listeners have probably at some point had contact with a park ranger.
Oh.
From a national park. Those are federal employees.
Are you saying that the park employees have not had a wage, inflation wage increase or whatever since, was it, 08?
Correct.
They get raises like as a normal employee, but so if you've been there, you've still gotten raises, but you just haven't gotten the general 1 point whatever increase?
I would have to look into that. I am not sure whether that federal agency has merit raises in addition to cost of living increases.
Man, because I hope so, because I like forest rangers.
Mm-hmm.
I found the one person. I'm trying to connect people to make them feel it in their hearts. You know what I mean? That's what
totally.
That's what I'm going for. I'm trying to be like, oh, you mean Ranger Bill's not getting a raise? That's bad. So oddly enough, our economy is soaring and is going to be soaring from here on out as long as Donald Trump is president. Only federal employees can't have raises because we don't have enough money. I'm assuming this is kind of feeding into something we discussed a few times before that giant $1.5 trillion tax cut.
We pointed it out. Bernie Sanders pointed it out. A bunch of other people have pointed it out ad nauseum, and people just don't seem to be getting it. The $1.5 trillion tax cut was passed without funding, i.e., was passed without any sort of plan for how the federal government will continue operations without that revenue, precisely because the GOP needed to generate a crisis, a man-made crisis, so that they could slash funding to programs and agencies that they have long reviled. And that's exactly what we're seeing happen. You know, the GOP at least had the decency to lie about it and sort of pretend that's not what they were going to do. But now all that's out the window. They're you know, now, especially now that Paul Ryan has said he's not going to run for office again, they've sort of given up all pretense and have said, that's our intention, is to destroy all of these social programs.
And I hadn't really thought about it as the Trump administration kind of going after other federal employees. There was something a little while back about taking a sledgehammer to the unions for federal employees just recently as well, too, right?
Yeah, and they lost. That's part of what they are so upset about.
You know who could affect these things as they come up in the future? There we go. Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. So last week, I was just throwing something out. Didn't want to really talk about it, just kind of bringing it up. And Sean said that he didn't think that Kavanaugh was going to get confirmed, which surprised me. I have heard that there's going to be difficult for him to not get confirmed, since we don't really have much power. We hold none of the levers, if you will. So I gave the only louder and a little more high pitched. And I said we get back to it, and now we're getting back to it. And there has been a little bit of news that has come out that makes me think that Sean might be a little more close to right on that, such as the White House withholding like 100,000 pages of documents from when Kavanaugh worked in the White House.
Yeah, they're withholding docs, which is going to make things more difficult.
I mean, is it going to make it more difficult? Is it going to get to for a Republican to go, oh, you're right, that doesn't seem right? Or are they just going to go, yeah, whatever?
Well, I don't think you're ever going to get to the point where they will come out publicly and say, oh, yeah, you're right, this doesn't seem right. But in the back room, what they're going to say is, I am being crucified at home over this Kavanaugh thing. I'm in a district where I could very well lose in November. Fuck you, I'm not voting for this guy before the November election. And that kind of political calculation takes place behind the scenes all the time. And that's sort of what I'm counting on. At no point did I think, by the way, maybe people misunderstood. At no point did I think the GOP was going to openly come out and be like, no, we're not electing Kavanaugh.
what'll happen is the scheduled date for his confirmation will get pushed back, you know, beyond the November election, which at that point pretty much kills his nomination, given the way that the elections leading up to, or given the way that the numbers leading up to the November election are trending, it's unlikely that the GOP will be able to muster political support after November for such a hard right candidate.
So if this is a quick answer, go ahead and give it to me. Okay. How exactly, again, did it happen that it went from needing a supermajority to just a majority on confirmations?
So that was never actually a law. It was a rule passed by the Senate. It was a rule passed by the Senate a very long time ago. But the Senate at any time could vote to do away with that rule. And that's what they did. It was never the supermajority requirement was never enshrined in the Constitution, unfortunately, nor was it ever enshrined in actual federal law, unfortunately. It was left as just a rule, and it was left as just a rule for exactly this reason, by the way. You know, both sides sort of agreed at some point we might want to change this on the fly, so let's leave it a little hazy. And they did, and now we are all fucked as a rule, as a result.
That was quick and depressing. Just, you know, some of the Kavanaugh things. He seems to be more on the downside of shady, or downside of totally cool with Roe versus Wade. Had some rulings that were very anti-union as well. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the big one being that he doesn't think that a president should be something to that effect.
That a president can't be indicted while in office.
After he tried to do it to Bill Clinton.
Correct.
He had a change of heart after he did that to Bill Clinton, and he felt real bad about it. Is he just going to get borked? Like, just kind of, this isn't going to work, and then Trump's going to have to come up with somebody?
Ultimately, what's going to happen here is there will be some Republican senators whose heads are on the chopping block in November who make it known behind closed doors that they will not support the nomination. The nomination won't get brought up for a vote. It will be delayed past the November election, and at that point, we're sort of through the looking glass. It's difficult for me to predict what's going to happen then.
Okay.
All right. But most likely he won't get an opportunity to make any further nominations.
Well, isn't it the Senate, or does he have to be confirmed into the House first?
No. So the Senate is the only one that votes to confirm on judicial nominees.
So, I mean, if the Senate stays the same.
If the Senate stays exactly the same, then they could try and force through nominations. But once they're past the midterms, those moderate Republicans in the Senate who are on the fence have no reason to be on the fence anymore. They don't need the Republican base to pull them through the 2020 midterm or the 2018 midterm elections. So it becomes even less likely that they will vote in support of a judicial candidate who looks bad on their voting record. So anyway, there's a few moderate Republican senators left out there. All of them have good Democratic opponents running against them this fall. And any one of them could, and I'm betting will, make the choice, the political calculation, that it is too risky for them to vote for a candidate like Kavanaugh. And the orange one will never appoint a moderate judge.
What Republican is going to get a conscience all of a sudden and vote against Kavanaugh past the primary? You know, like once the midterms are done, are now they're going to come out and say, I didn't want to say this before, but this Kavanaugh guy is kind of a whack job.
Yeah, not that they have a conscience. Again, this is just a dance to try and hold on to power.
If they get through and they make it, then clearly they were Trumpy enough to get that Trump base, which is what everybody's clinging on to. So if you want to keep those people, then you vote for Kavanaugh all the same, because that's what your Trumpy base wants. Like, I don't see
that's
a change
what,
of conscience.
So it's not that they would change their minds after the November election. Sorry. In the run-up to the primaries, they have been quiet about their position on Kavanaugh.
My expectation is now that the primaries are over, there will be some moderate Republican senators who will come out against Kavanaugh, either or they'll do it behind closed doors because they can't afford to vote for him before the general election. Because in the general election, there are some moderates out there in the country that will bury their foot up this person's ass if they vote for Kavanaugh.
Word. I still think it's a long shot.
Yeah, but... it's probably a long shot. Fuck it. But I need something to be hopeful about.
I'm just going to be super happy when I can be like, no, you got to go back to whatever, August 26th episode of Plastic Cup Politics podcast at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. And go look back. And Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, is the first one to call it. He said Kavanaugh's not going to make it.
Oh, God. Now you're putting the pressure on. Now I fucking hope he doesn't make it.
Don't worry. The only way people are going to listen to those old ass episodes will be if we point them there. Nobody's ever going to hear that shit.
Come on. I still want to be right, though.
I want you to be right as well. I mean, the country should hope that you are right as well.
Yeah.
Other things that a Kavanaugh Supreme Court might get to see rulings over is dealing with the opioid epidemic in this country. There have been places that are just having people dying left and right that want to open up injection sites that would be government-run places with paramedics on site where you can shoot up. And the DOJ has come out and say, don't even try doing that because we're shutting that down straight from here. And as a candidate that's running in 2020, Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, candidate 2020, what is your take on injection sites?
I think they're a fantastic idea. I think until we are prepared as a society to build an actual infrastructure for helping people deal with opioid addiction, this is the next best thing we can do to try and minimize the number of people who are dying every year as a result of overdoses and as a result of diseases transmitted via dirty needles. That's the other thing that these injection sites are likely to provide is clean needles upon request. Right. So you don't have to share a dirty needle with the people around you. You can go to the injection site and get a clean one right there. Right. This is it's a common sense public health step that is only opposed because there are powerful vested interests trying to make sure it never happens. It's not a principled position. That's what they're trying to get you to believe. They're trying to get you to believe that they're making a principled stand about drug abuse, and it's not. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the Correctional Corporation of America and other major multinationals like the CCA and the Corrections Officers Union spending tens of millions of dollars every election cycle to get politicians elected at the federal and state level who are sympathetic to these tough-on-crime propositions that have no effect on public safety or public health or crime rates, but they do tend to put a lot of people into cells in private prisons, and those private prisons are making billions of dollars every year in taxpayer money to warehouse those individuals. And we are all being taken for a ride right now. This has nothing to do with ethics or morals or a principled stand on drugs or public health. It all has to do with lining the pockets of these people's owners, of these Congress critters and the president's owners in the private prison industry and the Correctional Officers Union.
But we're not talking about legalizing these drugs. They're still illegal. So how do you get past that part of it?
So let's put it this way. The federal government wouldn't actually have the authority to just walk in there and sort of take over this state infrastructure. But what they could do was put federal agents in each of these safe drug locations, these what are they calling them? Safe sites?
Yeah, just like safe injection sites.
Which would essentially serve the same purpose, right? No one would ever show up to them if they knew that there was always going to be federal law enforcement there waiting for them. So yeah, it's not about the states aren't proposing making these opioids legal.
I guess this is a good point to ask you where you stand on all drugs, legalizing all drugs.
Well, they should all be legal. Look, we did this prohibition thing once already. All right. And we saw how it worked out. We passed a national ban on the production, sale, possession and consumption of alcohol. The organized crime, the mafia, already existed prior to the passage of prohibition, but they were fairly small potatoes. And then we created a legal environment where they could make a shitload of money running bootleg booze either in from the hills or across the border from Canada or Mexico. And we turned relatively small crime syndicates into massive multinational crime syndicates. Right. And we created some of the most powerful and colorful criminals in our country's history as a result of passing this law. And what's more important is rates of alcohol consumption, so far as we can tell, actually rose during prohibition. They didn't go down. People drank more booze after it was illegal, which, you know, for the cynics out there in the crowd, that actually sounds perfectly logical. If you think about human nature, of course they're going to fucking do it more if you tell them they can't. That's just the way people are. But we did this once before and it was a miserable fucking failure. And the only way we were able to fix it was by overturning prohibition and making alcohol legal again. That was the only thing we could do to ultimately undercut the power of the mob. It's the only thing we can do now to undercut the power of the cartels. The cartels are never going to go away until we legalize the sale, possession, and use of drugs in the United States across the board.
That is a pill too big for me to swallow. I can't do that. Nope. I think that alcohol is definitely not good for you. And I also make my living off of alcohol. And I also spend most of my free time with alcohol. You know what? Nobody's died from marijuana, and I do think that I think that at some point in time we will do a drug show and where we can talk about where my views have changed a hell of a lot in recent history and my views on marijuana. But I don't think that that's should be illegal, but I have never done heroin and I don't think I want to try it to make sure that I don't like it. It just seems like there are some things that are so dangerous that I don't know how you can make them in any way legal. Like, and then going back to the injection zones, when we were kids and your mom would tell you, don't drink, but if you do, don't drink and drive. You can call me at any hour of the night. I won't ask questions. I will just come and pick you up, okay? Because I don't want you to drink and drive. So do you want to tell Phoenix, don't do heroin? Like, whatever, you just don't do heroin. But if you do heroin, here's the place where you can do it, where it's where the government's there to make sure that you don't die.
Hell no. What I would tell my daughter is, I really don't want you to do heroin, and here's why. And I would lay out to her all, and I've already had this conversation with her, by the way, about both heroin and cocaine, and we've talked, you know, realistically about marijuana and alcohol. She's aware of all of them. The position that I've taken with my daughter is, once you're old enough, most of these drugs, if you decide to try them, they're not going to ruin your life. But there are some of them out there that are really bad for you. And so we've talked about in those terms things like crack, things like heroin. And my position with her has been, please don't do these things. They're not worth it. And they can hurt you very, very badly, especially when you don't know what you're doing with them. But if you are going to do them, come talk to me first.
Yeah, but you're not most parents.
No, that's true. But you know
and
what?
That's the thing.
And in most cases, I would say that's a good thing, right? Because I'm not always a fantastic parent. But in this case, I think most parents should actually be more like me. That the conversation that I had with my daughter is very similar to the conversation you would hear a parent over in Europe have with their kids about drugs and alcohol. And the idea is, look, we have to talk to them in terms that we know are going to be realistic and understandable to them, because they're, you know, their brains haven't developed to the same stage that ours have. Nevertheless, we have to talk to them in ways that empower them to make logical choices about their actions based on predicted outcomes. Right. We have to understand that even though they don't do it to the same degree that we do, they still do that. That's still how they're making their choices. So we have to provide them with evidence, and we have to provide them with logic. We can't just say, don't do it.
Facts.
It doesn't work.
Facts and not scare tactics.
Yeah, exactly. For example, and this is going to be another hot take, but there's actually some very good evidence out there about it. There was a doctor. It's killing me. I can't remember his name right now. He was on the Joe Rogan Experience last year. He wrote a whole book about, you know, part of about how we're doing a disservice to our children by lying to them about drugs, even the really bad ones, right? Like, we don't actually do anyone any favors by talking about heroin in terms of, if you try it once, you're going to be addicted. That's not the way heroin works. It's not the way any opioid works. But what we can do is talk to kids about the fact that, hey, if somebody offers you heroin and you don't know what you're doing and you use the wrong amount, you will die. That's real. That happens all the time. It's part of why people are proposing these safe sites. A lot of the danger is in early users, not people who are heavily addicted.
Well, now they're kind of cutting it with fentanyl. It's also,
yeah,
people that have been using for a long time because they don't know what's in it.
Yeah.
Oh, did you also hear that I forget which state is now using fentanyl for lethal injections?
Yeah, I saw that. That's nice. we're so desperate to be able to execute people that we're doing it with fentanyl. Here's what I would say to you and other folks who are a little squicked out by the idea of legalizing everything. I would say two things. One, legalizing everything doesn't necessarily mean you can walk into a pharmacy and buy heroin, right? Simply because it's legal doesn't mean the state has to facilitate it. Even though in many cases we're facilitating it right now through methadone programs. We're providing people with synthetic opioids already. But we don't have to make it so that you can go to CVS and buy smack, but we can still legalize it. The other thing that I would say is take a look at, we don't have to speculate anymore. We have countries out there where we have evidence on this. You take a look at what happened in Portugal after they decriminalized everything. Drugs and prostitution, boom, decriminalized all of it. Doesn't mean you can go anywhere you want in Portugal and buy anything you want. You know, at a drugstore, you're probably still going to have to deal with a drug dealer for most things that you want to buy, but you're not going to go to prison if you get caught. And if you're sick, if you do it wrong or you do too much, you can go to the hospital without worrying about getting thrown in a cage afterwards. Or if you OD, your friends can take you to a hospital without worrying about getting thrown in a cage afterwards. As opposed to what happens now in the United States, most of the time someone ODs, their buddies dump them on the doorstep of the ER and drive away because they're afraid that they're going to be locked in prison for the rest of their life.
I did see that there is Good Samaritan laws going, I forget where, but to defeat this, a law that actually says that if you drop somebody off that's ODing, you will not face prosecution. I forget what state, but at least somebody's looking out.
Yeah, yeah. But my point was, rather than drag that out, was to point you towards, you can look at exemplars like Portugal for an example of what happens when you legalize everything. Their rates of usage have gone down. Their incarceration rates obviously have gone down. Their rates of OD have gone down, right? It's the exact opposite of what most people fear would happen if you legalize everything, right? The idea is, oh God, if we take off all of the, if we take the gloves off completely, everyone's going to use smack. No, turns out far fewer people end up using it.
Man, that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you know, part of it, a lot of the people who are trying smack are young people. And what's the one thing you can be guaranteed with young people? It's that if you tell them not to do something, it will sound way better than if it was okay for them to do it in the first place.
Yeah, all the time people were, all the things were saying, don't do drugs. And you know what? I didn't do drugs.
Yeah, but lots of things also told you that it was bad for you to drink before you were 21, but you still did that.
Yeah, and it gatewayed me, 25 years later to start smoking weed. So,
oh my God, you horrible, horrible person, you. Oh, no.
But that's more of my issue with it, is that because you were having these talks with your child, my dad was the one who was doing presentations in my third grade classroom talking about drugs and bringing things in and explaining how that drugs make you see colors and you'll look at things and you can taste it. And my dad was the one who was
dad
giving
made drugs sound fantastic.
Kind of did, but no, my dad was the guy who came in and gave the anti-drug speech.
That's hilarious.
Honest to God, that did happen.
God, I wish I was there for that.
So when I turned 40 and I realized that drinking is okay, too much drinking is really, really bad for me,
yeah.
I started medicating otherwise. And now I'm like, God damn it. All this time, what was I afraid of? But
well,
so I don't want it to be... I don't now in my head, like if I was younger, I might go, they are so full of shit about this whole pot thing. They're probably full of shit about meth, too.
So there are probably a lot of people out there who do say that. And then they try meth and they realize, oh, fuck, they weren't lying about this meth shit. It's real scary. And they walk away from it. Right. The vast majority of people who try heroin don't get addicted to heroin. The vast majority of people who try meth don't get addicted to meth. That's part of the lie that we're telling that's doing a disservice to kids, right? Because as soon as they go out and they try something like meth or heroin and they don't immediately get addicted, they assume we were lying to them about everything else.
I do get that. I mean, of course I get that. That's what I just said a second ago.
Exactly.
Which we're going to get away from because we're done. I think we're done. Do you have anything?
I think we're done. I think we're done.
Yeah. Guess what? We're done, guys. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for just stick with tuning in. It works. I like it.
Thanks
we
for listening.
We still use the symbol of a little fucking handset from a handheld phone. Even on like cell phone buttons, that stupid goddamn anachronism is still there. We can still say tuning in.
Thank you for listening this far to Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. If you have any questions or comments or anything, you can hit us up at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, go ahead and subscribe. Give us some whatever they do, stars, however they want you to review it. Give us a review. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. And give us something. Give us a ray of hope, Sean.
The ray of hope, folks. We did well. We did. Even in those areas where, like, you know, like earlier, I said that Mr. Gilliam in Florida was not necessarily the right candidate for Floridians to have picked at this point in time. Nevertheless, it's still encouraging that even after 24 months that are as dispiriting as the last 2 years have been, Democrats are still turning out, and they're turning out in primary elections, and they are doing surprising things with their votes. That's all good news, folks. It's good news for everyone in 2020. So, you know, stay with us, stay motivated, stay upbeat, get out there, volunteer. Your next opportunity to vote isn't until November, but that isn't your only opportunity to act. Your local candidates need your help. Get in touch with them, get motivated, get involved.
Thanks, guys. We will talk at you again next week.
Whoa, 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 whoa. It's just a night.